Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Good Morning.
And good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. It's been a wild year for students and faculty at the University of Vermont. The campus stayed closed after spring break because of the coronavirus. Testing requirements and gathering restrictions transformed undergraduate life on campus. And now university administrators are proposing to cut more than a dozen academic majors, 11 minors, and 4 graduate programs in the liberal arts. So what does that mean for the students and instructors in those areas? Joining us to talk about the proposal is Katia Schwank, who covers Burlington for VT Digger, and looks like we'll be getting her in just a moment. Listeners, if you want to ask questions about UVM's proposed cuts, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And while we wait to see if we have Katia ready for the interview, I want to tell you that there will be 12 possible academic majors cut, 11 minors, 4 graduate programs in the College of Arts and Sciences. It was announced last week or a couple weeks ago, and there's been a lot of furor from those in the program, but also those who are not in programs that are affected by this announcement. And still no guest yet, so we keep trying. And I'll let you know what else we have scheduled for today. Coming up in the at 9:30, Beth Rusnak from National Life. She's the head of community relations. She will join us to let us know about the commitment to the community that National Life has made. And then in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll spend time with Cornelia Carey. She's the executive director of Surf Plus. It's the artist safety net. And that is based in Montpelier, helps artists all across the country. Also, Stephen Bronstein, who's a Marshfield blacksmith. He's the owner of Blackthorn Forge, and he will join us to let us know about the work he does, but also how he was able to be helped. All right, let me see if we can find... why don't you try to call Beth Rusnak now if we can't get Katia, and we'll try to flip these segments. Maybe Beth is available, and we'll double-check on the phone number that we have for Katia. She's not answering right now, and it's possible that sometimes, you know, I will transpose numbers, and maybe that's what I did in what I provided for our directors. So I'll just double check on that and continue. Okay. Okay. I have the right number. So we're going to see if we can get Beth Rusnak on the line now and talk about what's happening at National Life, and then we'll try to move Katia to 9:30. And I think that's what's happening. All right.
Yeah, see, I told you, Rick, when you take a couple of days off, we're going to punish you when you return.
So who do I have as a guest right now?
Beth Rusnak is joining us
right
on the line.
All right, Beth. Well, let me tell everybody a little bit about this segment, as we'll try to flip segments. First of all, on this show, you know, I have the opportunity, I hope, to speak with people, charities, businesses that make Vermont a wonderful place to live and that continue to do things the Vermont way. One of those businesses is National Life. They're based in Montpelier, and giving back, getting involved, making life better for those in the community are really part of the ethos of National Life. So, Beth Rusnak, thank you so much for stepping up and jumping into the 9 o'clock slot. You probably thought you had an extra half hour to prepare and get ready for this big interview, but you're here, and I'm happy to have you on Vermont Viewpoint right now.
Well, thanks so much, Rick. It's great to be here.
If you'd like to ask Beth about National Life's commitment to the community or to share how you've seen it happen, you can call us at 244-1777. 877-291-8255 is the toll-free number. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. So, Beth, first of all, give us a little bit of history of National Life in Vermont.
Absolutely. So National Life Group has been around in Vermont for 172 years. We've been a mainstay here and have been very proud to be here and reflect Vermont values. National Life at its core is a financial services company. So what we do is we provide life insurance and annuities to people all over the United States. So while we're headquartered here, we also actually have a campus in Dallas, Texas. We are national in scope. One of our focuses, though, is helping others in the communities in which we live and work. And, of course, Vermont is definitely high on our list of focuses.
So how has National Life incorporated its commitment to the community into the fabric of the company's daily mission?
What it's done is really taken to heart its mission, vision, and values. So many corporations honestly have very long mission and vision statements, paragraphs that nobody could ever remember.
Right.
Lots of words, lots of corporatese. What's really cool about National Life is that we don't. So, for example, our mission is keeping our promises. Our vision is to bring peace of mind to everyone we touch. And our values, which personally I love the most, are do good, be good, and make good. And what that means is that we really do live those values every day in everything we do. So whether it's the work we do with our policy owners, of whom we have over 1 million, actually, I just want to give a little shout out because we just reached that milestone recently and we're very proud of that. Whether it's working with our agents, because we sell through trusted financial service agents all across the country, or if it's working in our communities, we want to make sure that we're doing good for others and helping bring peace of mind, and we do that in many ways.
Well, explain, give a really solid example of how you do good, be good, and make good in those communities.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'll give you a recent example. A few months ago, we had learned that, earlier this year, we had learned, as I think we all have, that so many nonprofits who do such good work have been struggling because of the pandemic. It has been brutal. Not only has it been brutal for the nonprofit organization themselves, but of course it's been really brutal for those they serve. So in particular, one of our focuses is through our community relations is to help end childhood hunger in Vermont. Right now, the Vermont Food Bank and Hunger Free Vermont have learned that one third of Vermonters are food insecure, are having difficulty accessing healthy, nutritious food. And that is just heartbreaking. The good news is that there are organizations like ours who are stepping up and stepping in to help, as are a lot of individuals. We had heard that Washington County Youth Service Bureau, the Boys and Girls Club of Montpelier, did not have the resources this year to provide the traditional community Thanksgiving meal that they had in years past. This was a huge deal in Montpelier. In 2019, they had almost 900 meals that they served in person. So people would sit side by side and enjoy Thanksgiving together on Thanksgiving Day. They couldn't do it this year. So we had learned that and decided that we did not want folks to, number one, go without a meal, and number two, go without a traditional Thanksgiving meal. That just didn't seem right to us. So we reached out in the community. It's such a great, great community that we live in here. It's small. Vermont is pretty small, so everybody pretty much knows each other, which honestly helps. We asked our friends at Sodexo, who I'm not sure how many people are familiar with Sodexo, but they run the cafeteria at National Life's building in Montpelier, but they also run the cafeterias, for example, at UVM and Norwich and the Vermont State College Systems. And anyway, so they They know what they're doing. They are just incredible. They stepped forward and said, heck yeah, we could help. This is not a problem. We came together. We reached out to some of our other community partners, and before we knew it, we had the entire meal donated. The logistics around this, because, of course, we wanted to make sure we kept everyone safe, that was a little gnarly. You wouldn't believe how many spreadsheets we had.
Oh, my goodness.
That were color-coded. I want to give a huge shout-out to Christine Hartman in particular, who does work for the Washington County Service Bureau, who helped us with this. She is a rock star. She helped us with all of this because there were some gluten-free meals that needed to be delivered. There were other special dietary requests. We thought we would be distributing 650 meals, and in the end, we distributed 820.
So it's
something we're really proud of. It was delivery and pickup only, because of course we couldn't sit together this year, but hopefully next year will be much different.
We don't often get the word gnarly worked into a conversation here on Vermont Viewpoint, so I really enjoy that, especially when you gnarly logistics. But I can understand it had to have been really hair-raising, and congratulations to everyone who got the work done. Beth, you mentioned before we took a break about the Thanksgiving dinner in Montpelier, but what are some other projects that National Life employees get involved in?
Well, National Life employees get involved in so much in the communities, as I mentioned, in Dallas and Montpelier, where both of our campuses are. So the company, which is a very generous volunteer policy, encourages every employee to take 40 hours paid volunteer time annually. That, we think, is really fantastic, and many employees do. What some will do, for example, is they might take all 40 hours in one fell swoop, and they might volunteer at Camp Tecumseh for the entire week. Others might go gleaning. That's a very popular activity, as I mentioned. One of our focuses is hunger. So many of us sit in front of a computer all day, and it is just really nice to be able to get away from that computer and honestly go pull potatoes out of the ground or apples off of the tree, especially when we know that they're going to help feed someone else. So that's one way we as individuals are empowered to go and give back in our communities. And then there are some other larger things that we do that we're really proud of. So two examples. I don't know if you've heard of the Do Good Fest. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we were not able to host it this year because of the pandemic. But we have put on an amazing benefit music festival for 7 years on our campus in Montpelier. The intention is to bring the community together to celebrate what is so great about Vermont, everything from great food. We have food trucks and amazing musicians, both national and local. We have a kids area, we have a beer tent, and what is near and dear to my heart is that we have a nonprofit village, and we invite 35 nonprofits to come and just share with the community what they do and build awareness. It has been remarkable, and all the proceeds from that concert go to Branches of Hope, which is the cancer patient fund at the National Life Cancer Treatment Center in Berlin at Central Vermont Medical Center. So that's another bigger thing. And then bringing it back down a little bit, more recently, one really incredible initiative that our IT department took was they reached out and they had shared that as they were starting to upgrade some of our laptops, the older ones were still functional, and was there anything that we can do with those? And the answer, of course, is yes. So our IT department has to date refurbished almost 175 laptops, monitors, and tablets that we have been donating to really great organizations like Prevent Child Abuse Vermont and Central Vermont Mental Health Services and Central Vermont Adult Basic Education for telehealth appointments. So really good stuff.
That is fantastic. You mentioned Do Good Fest. Do you know how much has been raised during the years you've had it?
Yes, over $200,000.
Wow.
Has been raised. Yeah. Again, something that we're just so proud of and has been incredible. And really interesting story with that, too. So the year before we had started this, what we had learned was that the way in which funds were raised for the Cancer Patient Fund was that nurses would hold bake sales. And to their great credit, because as we know, nurses definitely have their hands full and do amazing work, they would raise almost $1,000 every year for this. So the year that we were able to come back and provide them, let's just say, a much larger check for the great work that's happening was just incredible.
Wow, that is so great. And it is a great way that National Life puts its weight behind these programs. You mentioned earlier that National Life is dedicated to keeping its promises. If I remember correctly, you know, you've been in existence since sometime in the 1800s and have paid off on every policy, even through the toughest of times.
That's right. Yep. So 1848 is when we were started, and we have been through all of these difficult situations, to say the least. Everything from the Great Depression to the wars to the recession to pandemics.
Yeah, the previous pandemic.
yeah. Who would have ever thought that there'd be another one? But right. Here we are. And we are really proud of the fact that we work really hard to build really strong relationships with our policy owners. And one of the things that we do is, and I will tell you, I learned. So my background is marketing. I don't have a financial background. And when I stepped into the financial services arena, what I learned about life insurance is that there are many components to it. Including something called living benefits, in which if you become ill, you could use your life insurance policy to help with certain things that are happening during your illness. So it's a great way to protect you and your family, and it's something that we're really proud of. So going back to the vision of the company to bring peace of mind to everyone we touch, we just feel like we're here to help protect families. We're here to help protect businesses. One of our major markets is small businesses. And we're here to help protect people's retirements. So if we're protecting families, why wouldn't we help in the community as well, however we can?
Well, one way you do that is a program called, I think it's called Main Street Across America. Tell us what that's about.
Sure. So my colleague Ross had started our Main Streets Across America program a number of years ago. And what that does is it recognizes those small businesses on our main streets. So the beauty is, of course, that in Montpelier, we actually have a main street, as there are in many small communities. And we recognize that it takes a lot to really make our economy chug along. But one of the catalysts of that are small businesses together. So we are very supportive of our communities, of the small businesses there. We, as a community relations department, had a program called Main Street Grants, and what we had done recently is we actually transitioned to a statewide program called the Working Communities Challenge that we are one of a number of funders. I had mentioned connections earlier and how one of the really beautiful things about Vermont is how we all work together to help lift each other. We've done that with these communities, with the Working Communities Challenges, and that means that they will support economic development in these communities as well.
Can you point out somewhere where it's been put into place in Vermont?
Yeah, sure. So the Working Communities Challenge, those grants were recently announced, as a matter of fact, just about a month ago, and where they will be benefiting includes Winooski, the Springfield area, Barrie, great work happening in Barrie. And I have to tell you, I'm forgetting the fourth.
All right. Well, that's all right. You were aroused a half hour early to come on this program. So, you know, if you go, 75% on that question, that's totally okay. But so what does that look like, though, in actuality in one of those communities?
absolutely. Let me tell you what's going on in Barrie. This I think is incredible.
Good.
So, the Barrie community has come together. What they had to do was they had to provide an application and explain how they would support, a segment of the community that would actually help overall lift that entire community. So their focus is on, single moms, who are living in poverty, and what does it look like to help those families really get out of poverty, get the services that they need so that they could get full-time employment, childcare, because so often many of these situations are really, there are multiple prongs to it. It's not just that somebody, for example, is food insecure. It's often that they are unemployed or that they have a medical issue or both. They're having difficulty paying rent. They can't get gas for their car to get to their job. They don't have childcare. It's all intertwined and really, really challenging. What Barrie did was recognize that they have almost 1,000 women that they could support with wraparound services, working with local employers like National Life as one of them to help these families get back on their feet. And when they do, they start becoming more solvent, and what I mean by that is that they could support the local economy, that they are more successful personally and professionally, and it just benefits everyone.
Hmm. And Beth, is there a way that someone who would want to learn more about your community outreach could do so?
Absolutely. So if you go to nationallife.com, all of our community information is located at the top under Our Story. And there you'll find information about our foundation, about Do Good Fest, about another great program we have called Life Changer of the Year. That recognizes and rewards school employees all across the nation. And now is such a great time to do that. Actually, if I could give a little plug, if mm-hmm. anybody knows of a great school employee, and it could be, for example, a bus driver, it could be a teacher, it could be a superintendent or a principal, definitely you can nominate them right online. And that's actually at lifechangeroftheyear.com. Wonderful program. So anyway, all that information is on nationallife.com.
All right. Life Changer of the Year. I love that program as well. Beth Rusnak is the head of community relations for National Life. I want to thank you so much for stepping in at the last minute and being on early on Vermont Viewpoint this morning, Beth. Thank you.
Absolutely. Happy to. It's great to be here. Thank you.
All right. All right. We'll be back after this CBS News break. Not sure what we'll be talking about, but we'll figure it out on the fly in the next few minutes.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
And we're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. When you think of art, from pencil drawing to metal sculpture to ballet, you probably don't think of how much the artist had in savings when they made their creation, or what happens to an artist's livelihood if, for example, a boulder falls on the home studio or a fire wipes it out. But the Montpelier nonprofit Surf Plus, the artist safety net, is dedicated to making sure that artists dealing with career-threatening crises can get help right away. Today, we are going to be joined by the executive director of Surf Plus, Cornelia Carey. We're going early. She's not quite ready yet, but we do have Stephen Braunstein, who is a blacksmith in Marshfield. He's the owner of Blackthorn Forge, and he was on the receiving end of some of that crisis aid from Surf Plus. And Stephen, great to have you on the program.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Hey, thanks for moving things around and being on a little early for us. Now, listeners, our numbers are 244-1777 and 877-291-8255. If you'd like to ask our guests a question about Surf Plus, or if you'd like to ask Stephen about blacksmithing, and you can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And Stephen, first of all, you know, tell us about blacksmithing. You know, I always think of it as more of kind of something, you know, someone making horseshoes, but you do it in an art form. So tell us about what you do.
Sure, my pleasure. And it's true. I mean, lots of people, that's what they think about horseshoeing as being blacksmith. And that's kind of, because that's the last job that blacksmiths continued to do into the 20th century. So in the 50s and 60s, there were still blacksmiths around, and they were doing horseshoeing. Blacksmiths were actually always in the community, but they had just become specialists. So they were the spring shop, maybe car mechanics, welding shop, machinists, locksmiths. Those are all subsets of what blacksmithing is, which is working with metal. So I started blacksmithing 40 years ago, when the craft movement was sort of getting a little, some resurgence in the early 80s. And for me, blacksmithing, which is also part of the traditional blacksmithing, is forging things out of metal. And they could be home accessories. It used to be, tools around the house, kitchen utensils, silverware, all, just everything that was made out of the metal at home was made by the blacksmith. In modern times, blacksmiths make more of the beautiful things in the home. So I make candelabras and clocks and vases and garden sculpture. And not in the, I can do it and it comes up, but my regular bread and butter is more, I'm a modern blacksmith. So it's more, now it's 21st century. What I started is the 20th century. And blacksmiths have always done whatever contemporary design was happening. That's what they did.
And I think your website is blackthornforge.com, blackthorn with an E. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And if you have the opportunity, go to blackthornforge.com as we're speaking and see some of the beautiful work that Stephen does. I'm amazed by the clocks that you do, everything from desk clocks to wall clocks that you smith. Really beautiful stuff.
Well, thank you. And, you know, it's interesting. Clocks were one of the first things that I did when I started. I was doing colonial ironwork. And part of it was, it's kind of all I knew. And then it took me a while to realize that blacksmithing isn't the colonial period. That's just one spot on the timeline of blacksmithing, 3,000-year-old craft. So that really, I could do anything I wanted as a blacksmith. I really wasn't constrained by some arbitrary rule. Because I started looking at historical work, and there's Louis XIV ironwork and Art Deco and Art Nouveau, like I said, whatever the styles were of the day. So the clocks were a way for me to forge a little piece of sculpture, put a mechanism in it, make it functional, kind of justify its existence, and there I had something I could sell at craft fairs.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, we think of it more as really... you know, some heavy hardware, but you do some delicate stuff that really looks beautiful. Stephen, I want to let you know that we're also now joined by Cornelia Carey, who is the executive director of Surf Plus. So, Cornelia, thank you for adjusting your clock today and moving up a bit to help us out here on Vermont Viewpoint. It's great to have you.
Oh, great to be here, Rick and Steve. Perfect timing.
Okay.
Speaking of timing.
Hi, Cornelius. Nice to hear from you.
Well, Cornelia, let's talk about Surf Plus. And for listeners, it's C-E-R-F Plus. So what do the letters C-E-R-F stand for?
They stand for Craft Emergency Relief Fund.
And then the plus sign.
And the plus sign, so after Hurricane Katrina, we recognized that in addition to having an emergency relief fund available to artists working in craft disciplines, we also needed to provide information and resources on how to mitigate disasters or how to be more prepared in the face of disasters. So the plus is all the other work that we do to help artists build more resilient careers.
How long has Surf Plus been around?
We've been around since 1985. Mm. And we were founded by glass artist by the name of Josh Simpson, who actually is a former Vermonter. I think he had a studio at Goddard College many, many moons ago. He now lives in Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. And he and a woman named Carol Sedestrom Ross, who had founded the American Craft Council shows, kind of put their heads together during a show at some point, recognizing that at almost every craft show there was somebody who had showed up who'd had an emergency in their life, a fire, or theft, illness, whatever. And it happened, you know, often, and people would literally pass the hat at these shows. And they decided that, you know, they wanted to institutionalize that grassroots effort. And so they raised, funds over the next 2 years and began, you know, giving out grants after that. So we always wonder, you know, in this time of crowdfunding, would an organization like SURF have ever come about? Big question. But we're glad that it did.
Absolutely. Well, Stephen, you were helped out by SURF Plus in 2017. So what brought you and SURF Plus together?
First of all, I want to back up just a sec.
Sure.
So that, Cornelia, you may not be aware, but I remember when Josh set up SURF, and we were just at the show, and the word just went around, can you put some money into the hat just so we could start creating this fund? So, just for history, I was there, too.
Oh, wow.
You were at the beginning.
How about that?
I was at the beginning. So, and then many years later, I became the recipient. So I was away on vacation, and I get a phone call from my daughter that my shop had burned down. And I didn't have great Wi-Fi connection. It was hard for me to find out what was going on. There was this crisis happening. And it was devastating. And all I'm seeing is photographs of my shop burned to the ground. I'm self-employed, which means I now no longer have a means of making any income. And it was rather devastating. And then almost immediately, within hours, I get an email from Les Snow from SURF. We heard you're having a problem. Let us know if you can help. And my brain is sort of spiraling at this point, and I don't even know what it is I need at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I get another email from him. Well, we're filling out the paperwork. We filled out the application.
Oh.
Just sign it, send it back. We'll take care of it. And within hours, maybe it was a day, there was a chunk of money that just got me breathing room.
Mm-hmm.
Just for the next, whatever, you know, short period of time, but it's like, okay, I can collect myself.
Wow.
Figure out what the next steps are.
Mm.
And I have to tell you, I'm choking up a little bit right now.
Yeah, no kidding.
It was amazing.
All right. And was anything saved from the fire at all, or did you lose everything in that fire, Stephen?
In the grand scheme, I was incredibly lucky. Because I'm a blacksmith. So when my brother sent me the pictures, I'm looking at 3 feet of ash. It was a three-story old timber frame barn. Everything's covered in ash. And I'm looking and peeking out of the ash, I could see my anvil. Hmm. I could see my vices. My tool rack was still sitting in the middle of the room with all the tongs and tools on it. All the hammers are still lined up. The handles are burned away, but they're sitting there in the fire. So as huge a conflagration that fire was, it was nothing compared to the heat needed to make those tools. I sifted like an archaeological dig through all the ashes. Took about 3 months. Actually, we're still digging a little bit. And saved most of my tools. So I knew I was going to be okay. I was going to be shut down for a while. But that the tools that I'd collected for 40 years, which are kind of hard to find. You don't have old blacksmith tools around. They were still there. And even like little punches, 2-3-inch punches, tiny tools, we sifted, got them.
Mm.
So I'm back up. I'm in my shop now looking around, and all those tools are right kind of where they were.
Oh, wow. What a fantastic story.
And he rebuilt just the most beautiful studio. I mean, I'm not sure, Steve, if you're taking guests at this time, but people definitely should drive by at least and just see what he put back together again, which was just remarkable. And for the longest time, he was working out of one of those big storage bins.
Yeah.
I don't know what you call those things.
Shipping container, yeah.
Oh,
shipping
my gosh.
Container. There was Steve, like, working away in a shipping container.
Oh, Steve.
But, you know, he's literally, you know, from the ashes, this guy. Just amazing, you know, to watch the recovery. He lives pretty close to where I live in Plainfield, and, you know, we got to just watch it, you know, come up and get back together again.
Blackthorn Forge.
Well,
go ahead, Steve.
Well, I want to make sure I give credit where it's due. I mean, there was so much. I was the recipient of so much help.
Mm-hmm.
So first there's Surf, right, to get me situated. But even prior to that, the local fire department, they were here so fast, the volunteer fire department, one of the guys on the squad the fire was at 11 o'clock at night, happened to be on his porch looking out his window, saw the blaze. So even before it was called in, he's running to the fire department because he drives the truck.
Wow.
And they were here in like 12 minutes. The shop was devastated, but there's a little house next door. There's a 1,000-gallon propane tank, all taken care of, so no crises. My friends showed up in the ashes, immediately got a shipping container on the property. Like the next day, my buddy Justin calls up the shipping container company, and they immediately go, oh, we heard about it. The container's on the way. So there was the box that they could, people who were pulling tools that were just sitting outside in the ashes, throwing them in the container to protect them for me. So I was on vacation. I stayed there. I didn't come back because basically we were told to leave it alone until the insurance company, we had things to work out. I just was insulated from the immediate trauma for about 7 days, and I took full advantage because I knew what I was going back to.
Yeah, amazing.
So it was rather amazing, yeah.
And let's take a call from Sterling, who's calling in from Middlesex. Sterling, good morning. Go right ahead. Hi, Sterling, are you there? Sterling, we'll give you one more chance. Are you there, Sterling? Okay, well, he had a question for Stephen about blacksmithing, but alas, we can't hear from Sterling. We'll see if we can get him back on the line. So, Cornelia, we heard about the help that Stephen got here in Vermont, but tell us about some of the work that Surf Plus has done elsewhere in the country.
Yeah, well, as you can imagine, this has been an especially challenging year for so many artists. COVID aside, which, you know, we've had a COVID-19 relief grant, but there's also been historic wildfires, especially in California, and also an historic hurricane season. And then we also respond to the, quote, everyday emergencies, you know, such as illness and studio fires like Steve experienced. So that's kind of what we've been looking at this year. I would say up until this year, probably 2018 was one of our busier years when we saw Hurricane Harvey, Maria, and Irma. And then a very active wildfire season as well. And in Hurricane Maria, you can imagine how many artists and artisans live in Puerto Rico, for example. And so we did quite a bit of work with the community of artists there, many of whom reported to us that was the only financial assistance that they were able to get, you know, after some devastating losses. So that certainly was one of those years you thought, okay, I don't want to ever see something like that again. And sure enough, 2020 roll around. So, yeah.
Well, Stephen, I don't want to ask you, you know, about your personal finances, but, you know, an artist does definitely have to rely on the selling of their art pieces that they create and cover things like the rest of us have to, insurance, et cetera. So, you know, how is it for an artist, you know, to get by, to make ends meet and the pressures that you have to have a career in the arts?
You know, I'm happy to share that. And even just my own personal finances, that I think it's important for people to sort of understand how it works. That mm-hmm. because I'm a self-employed person, if I don't have my hands and eyes and ears and all my faculties available, I can't make a living. So it is this precarious position, you know, and not like other tradespeople. And luckily, I did, because I have a slightly bigger business than some craft artists. A lot of craft artists just work by themselves. And usually those folks are working completely without a safety net. They don't have health insurance. They often don't have any kind of business insurance. So when something bad happens, it's just devastating. And there, you know, and there is no other go-to place other than SURF. And organizations like that, and there aren't a lot of organizations like SURF, so it's really special that we have that available. But in terms of like my own income, luckily I do slightly better than minimum wage, but not by much. And I think within the craft world, I'm relatively successful in that I've been doing it for this long. This is how I support myself. I have a family. Luckily, my wife also has a steady job, so mm-hmm. we would be in trouble without two incomes. And I make things and go to trade shows. I go to these big craft fairs where galleries and craft shops go, and that's how, when you're out traveling in the world and you go to a craft shop, that's how those business owners find us, at these trade shows. So that's just a critical, that's how I can live in Vermont and sell to companies and craft shops all over the country.
Mm-hmm. Cornelia, what's your interest in the arts?
I just wanted to add quickly sure. to what you're saying, Steve, which, you know, so it's very much episodic income. So Steve goes to a bunch of shows in a normal year. I bet he's not going to any shows now. But that income, unlike, you know, my paycheck, is very episodic. And so to have that suddenly cut off as well is very concerning. We look at a lot of tax forms, and this is not, you know, a community of high earners for the mm-hmm. most part. But
Cornelia,
anyway,
speaking of cut off, I'm going to have to cut you off for right now. We will be
okay.
back, though. Stay with us. We're going to come back and talk more about SURF Plus. Very interesting. The artist safety net and how they're helping artists. We'll be back after the CBS News. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. During this pandemic, we've been denied many opportunities to experience the visual and performing arts, and that has affected the livelihoods of so many artists and craftsmen as well. And this morning, we're learning about the organization based in Montpelier that is a safety net for artists. It's called SURF Plus. We have their executive director, Cornelia Carey, and blacksmith Stephen Bronstein on with us to discuss the work of SURF Plus. Listeners, if you have questions, you can call us at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Now, so Cornelia, right before I went to the break there, you were about to answer my question about your interest in the arts.
Yes, my interest in the arts goes back, to my childhood, but I'm not going to share that long story with you. but I actually, my reason for being in Vermont was when I became grants officer at the Vermont Arts Council, where I spent many happy years overseeing their organizational grants and what was then the Artist Fellowship Program. And it was a fantastic way to get to know the state of Vermont through the eyes and vision of artists and what they were, doing in their careers, and also the incredible cultural organizations that are throughout the state. So that was a fantastic introduction, and then when this position came up at Surf Plus, it seemed like a wonderful opportunity to take my interest in the field, specifically of craft, and go national, and so that's that was now almost 25 years ago.
Wow.
That I've been at Surf. Yeah. As I always say, I had brown hair when I started.
So what are the most common types of crises that your craftspeople, your artists experience that Surf Plus helps with?
Well, certainly in recent years, it's been climate change related emergencies, just historic hurricanes. I think it, really since Hurricane Katrina, I can honestly say that natural disasters are the number one thing that we're responding to. But we also see, a lot of artists facing, career disrupting or career ending illness and injury. Illness, again, as Steve pointed out, being an artist doesn't necessarily come with health insurance, and it really wasn't until the Affordable Care Act that more artists had more health insurance, and now that's certainly in question. You're again the lack of a safety net and no place to turn.
Stephen Cornelia mentioned natural disasters, and we usually, when we talk about them, we think of the need for water and food and electricity. But what do those events look like through the lens of artists, of people in the crafts community that you're a part of?
Yeah, it's interesting. So with my situation, in January is typically when I have my trade shows. So that's when I go and I get orders for about 6 months. So I've got 6 months worth of orders to do. And that January I came home, I started making the work. And of course there's no income from Thanksgiving to the next season. I'm kind of like a farmer. The crop has gone out, I'm waiting for the next crop to happen. So I get back from my show in January and I'm starting my production to start getting some income again. And in March, when I was just beginning to start to ship out my orders, the fire happened. So that meant all of my income for the first 6 months of the year was eliminated. And that's devastating, obviously.
Yeah.
So your gam, businesses, funny, artists don't think about it. But just like everybody else, we're in business with all of the problems that businesses bring, and basically you're gambling and you're hoping that whatever you're doing is going to work out in a way that by the end of the year you have more money in your pocket than when you started, and it doesn't always work out that way.
Yeah. Cornelia, tell us about the grants that you give to artists.
So we offer immediate grants of $3,000 for artists that have encountered a unforeseen career-threatening emergency in their lives. And we also work with a community of manufacturers, suppliers, show producers who also add to that package of assistance and donate from their businesses. And often, for example, right now we're working with Scott Kilns in Portland, Oregon, who manufacture beloved kilns. And, they've been donating, three kilns a year, which is very significant. And there are a lot of businesses that participate. Rio Grande, if you're a jeweler out there, you probably know them well. They've been very generous in offering our beneficiaries discounts on, retooling. And so with COVID-19, we have run two cycles. We're planning on running a third relief cycle. Those grants are really fast-moving, $1,000 grants for those facing most dire circumstances, food, health, and housing insecurity. And, that's just to help pay immediate bills. And even the requests for that have been just through the roof. And unfortunately, you know, we've had to run that like a lottery, because we just don't have the resources to respond to everyone's need there. So,
how are those monetary grants funded, Cornelia?
Well, they're funded by artists themselves, actually. Mm. Surface heavily supported by the community it serves. So those are, you know, everything from annual gifts of $5 to $200,000 individual gifts. Individuals and small family foundations and donor advised funds and the rest. We also get funding from some foundations. For those of us in the craft field who are aware of, Wingate Foundation has been very generous and supportive of our work for many years now, and as well as Andrew W. Mellon Foundation is helping us develop a stronger network of artist-responding organizations, kind of taking SURF's work and spreading it more around the country to build more resilience in the artist community. And then finally, businesses, related businesses to the craft field, and we have also been a beneficiary of funding from the National Endowment for the Arts as well, which is our federal arts grant-making institution.
Now, Stephen mentioned earlier... Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Stephen. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would just like to jump in because Cornelia's not giving herself quite the credit she deserves. Mm-hmm. So at these trade shows, which is where some of the best craft artists in the country show up, and it happens twice a year. And what Cornelia did was she got all the artists, so people within the craft community are very supportive of SURF. We all contributed some of our really best work, created this museum-quality display, and then the gallery owners come in and bid on the work so that they could put in their galleries, and these were huge fundraisers. And it just showed the depth of support that the craft community has for SURF and how much we appreciate it.
Yeah, it's very much, you know, unlike in other arts disciplines, it's very much a community supporting itself. In other words, we're not the Pollock Krasner Foundation that's dealing with Jackson Pollock's estate and distributing, you know, the rewards off of that incredible estate.
Right.
We kind of fund ourselves heavily. And, you know, one aspect of our work I haven't spoken about, which is just not as... sexy, but actually I think is among the most important things that we do is this advocating for small business and recognizing that, you know, we've got a gig economy now and there are a lot of self-employed workers. And, you know, with this pandemic, we're seeing, you know, much more folks in this country connecting to unemployment insurance, for example, and artists being able to access that, with the CARES Act, for example, and, you know, trying to figure out how we can extend the benefits that have come out of this pandemic to future disasters so that artists have, you know, access to unemployment insurance and or can access the Paycheck Protection Program, and that those programs address the way self-employed workers work, which is often a lot of hybrid income, some of it W-2, some of it earned income. You know, it's not, you know, your, quote, typical business. But in Vermont, I think I'm right in saying this, at least 80% of our businesses are 1-2-person operations, so it's really resonates. I know, you know, this is an issue Peter Welsh has taken up with great passion, is, you know, how to protect these small businesses, which are really, you know, the bread and butter of our communities.
And we have a call from Alyssa in Montpelier. Go right ahead, Alyssa.
Hi, Cornelia and Steve. How are you doing?
Hey, Alyssa.
Hi.
I work part-time as a book artist in Montpelier, And I have found that because of COVID, my income has dropped by half. I do a lot of teaching, and I had a couple of gigs out in Ohio, and obviously I couldn't travel there. And craft shows canceled. I usually do an open studio event in my home, and that was canceled. We did do an online version of it, but it's not quite the same. And I would say the thing that's been most helpful to me this year is I was able to get a number of grants that have kept me afloat, from the Small Business Administration, the Agency of Commerce and Community Development, the Arts Council, and the Vermont Crafts Council as well.
Alyssa, thanks for sharing that. Cornelia, that kind of brings up the plus side again of Surf Plus. With artists who are undergoing so much of loss of income because of the coronavirus, how do you counsel them on, you know, what is available, what they can apply for, those kinds of things?
Yeah, and Alyssa, thanks for that call. What we have seen since the shutdown of COVID-19, a lot of community development financial assistance programs like the Vermont Loan Fund and the Vermont Arts Council and Vermont Crafts Council and a number of others have really stepped up to the plate with emergency funds for artists. And all around the country we've seen this. We've seen about at least 400 emergency funds, some of which, you know, came on board early on and, you know, had spent all of their money, and some of them, you know, later on, and hopefully we'll continue to see that. So that is something to stay on top of. We have tried to keep our website very current with that information. So if you go to www.surfplus, that's C-E-R-F as in Frank, plus, P-L-U-S, .org, there's information and resources there on where you might turn to for assistance. And we will have another relief fund cycle cropping up in January, with grants being distributed in February. And so definitely stay in touch. The Vermont Arts Council is also a great resource for information for artists in the state, and so definitely connect there. Also, there's the New England Foundation for the Arts, which is our regional arts council in New England, another place to look into.
Stephen, so. Alyssa is a book artist. She mentioned how the pandemic has affected her and her business. How have you been affected by the pandemic there at Blackthorn Forge?
Well, I had the same similar experience as Alyssa, that we're probably down half. Mm. So my income is, you know, half of what it was last year. I had a little saving grace, which was that I do have a fair amount of online sales customers. So that's, you know, in the pandemic, online sales continued. So that's really what has kept me busy. You know, and there's just one more resource I want to plug, too.
Sure.
Alyssa and I are on the board of the Vermont Crafts Council, which is another organization that Vermont is really rather amazing, the kind of support you can get. So the Vermont Crafts Council focuses primarily on craft artists, but similar, hopefully either providing education, providing grant money. We got COVID money that we were able to distribute. And another thing that Surplus did, at least right after my fire, that we put out some, they do a lot of education. So what was my experience and, you know, what can we learn from it? And part of it was, I wasn't as insured as well as I thought I was.
Hmm.
So I did have some insurance, but
right.
It turned out it was about half of what I needed to recover. And amazingly, some community people did a GoFundMe page for me. I got a lot of support from my neighbors. Between that and SURF and insurance and some other help, I was able to rebuild. But if I didn't have all of that help available, it would not have happened.
Wow.
And, you know, it's that kind of knife edge that we all live on.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Steve, I'm glad you mentioned business insurance, because it's, you know, the both the talk about not sexy but and boring at the same time, but it's so critical for artist businesses, and it's not an all or nothing kind of thing. So, you know, if there are any artists listening to this, just, you know, kind of figure out what you can't afford to live without, and make sure that you have the coverage you need. And we have gone very deep on resources about business insurance on our website, just acknowledging that, yes, our $3,000 grants might help you, you know, bridge a gap, but it's a gap, you know, till your insurance check arrives, and that's what's really going to be the big help when you've had a total loss fire like Steve experienced.
Cornelia, when someone applies, go ahead, Stephen.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's fine.
I was thinking more about, you know, craft artists as a group. The reason we're artists is because, you know, we have this creative drive. We like making things. All the things we like to do. None of that, if you ask any artist on the list of things that they want to do, running a business, not on the list.
and buying business insurance, right?
Right. Yep. And you start talking about just, oh, you have to file a quarterly report, and you can see the terror, you know, the deer in the headlight look in people's eyes, because it's just not what they do. And also, it may not be in their skill set.
Right.
You know, the skills that make you a great artist might make you a really lousy business person.
Sure.
And we need artists, we need craftspeople, and somehow we have to do this. And that's where my community came through for me, that they showed their appreciation for the intrinsic value of having a blacksmith shop in their community. Not that they needed me personally, but just Vermont is so special because we have craft artists and people doing these alternative, kind of weird, kind of wonderful things, and isn't that great? And then it's not that economically rewarding specifically to the artists and maybe the community, but think about all those people who come to Vermont to see us.
Right.
You know, they want to come to Vermont to see the blacksmith shop, to see the potter at work, to see the painters. They may not spend money in our shop, but they love seeing us. And then they go out to dinner, and then they stay at the hotels, and we are part of this million-dollar industry, multi-million-dollar industry. And it's a value that we add to Vermont, and I'm happy to have it be appreciated.
I love that. Cornelia, we only have a few minutes left, but I do want to ask you, when someone does apply, now Stephen didn't have to, you all filled out his application for him, but when someone applies for a grant, what are you looking for in that application?
Yes. Well, we try to establish that, first of all, they're an artist working in a craft discipline, and then also that they have had an unforeseen career-threatening emergency that has upended their livelihoods. And, you know, this also includes artists who might not be in the marketplace in the way that Steve and Alyssa are, artists who are culture bearers in our country or in territories or on Indian reservations. You know, so there are different ways that people establish with us, you know, the fact that they are an artist working in a craft discipline. We pretty much are quite inclusive in our definition of that and what it means to, you know, to be an artist.
How many people does Surf Plus help in a year? Oh, go ahead, Stephen.
To fill out the application, I mean, I got help because Les was a neighbor, so he knew everything about me that had to go on the piece of paper. it was only, Cornelia, am I correct? Is it just one page? Maybe it's two
pages? It's pretty easy. It's a pretty easy process. It doesn't take a lot of time, and we're also really happy to work with people, recognizing that a lot of artists don't have the experience of writing grants. We try to make it a pretty user-friendly experience. Yeah.
And how many people does Surf Plus help in a year?
Well, this is not a typical year. We've helped close to 800 artists with over $1.2 million. A typical year is more you know, around 100, 150. It really varies depending on what's out there in the way of major disasters.
That tells us a lot about this year we've had, hasn't it? Stephen Bronstein is a blacksmith from Marshfield. Cornelia Carey is the executive director of Surf Plus, and you can find Surf Plus at CERFplus.org. I want to thank you both so much for being on and moving your schedules ahead by a half hour. I'm very grateful. Thank you both.
Thank you for the opportunity. Happy holidays.
You too. We'll be back after a CBS News update here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. UVM administrators are proposing to cut more than a dozen academic majors, 11 minors, 4 graduate programs in the liberal arts. So what does that mean for the students and instructors in those areas? Joining us to talk about the proposal is Katia Schwenk, who covers Burlington for VT Digger. Katia, I want to thank you for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
All right, great. Listeners, if you have questions on UVM's proposed cuts, you can give us a call at 244-1777, also 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Katia, so much going on these days that it can be hard to keep track of. So for starters, are these cuts being proposed in response to the pandemic, or did something else spur the change?
Yes, so that is a key question. So, you know, I think that what the university is saying is that while the pandemic has sort of exacerbated the underlying issues that caused these cuts, it really is not only in response to the pandemic. So the university has sort of been trying to figure out what to do with its College of Arts and Sciences for a long time. They've faced declining enrollment in that school following the recession in 2008, and have never really gotten back. So they've been contending with low enrollment for, you know, more than a decade. They're sort of contending with, in addition to that, increased budget deficits this year, but they've had budget deficits in the College of Arts and Sciences, which is the program that's being targeted for cuts for the last couple years. So really this is in response to a decade of low enrollment and, you know, a sort of increasing budget issues. It's not really a new problem.
You don't need to name every single one, but can you give us an idea of what kinds of programs that we're talking about that could face the chopping block?
Yeah, so we are talking about 23 programs across the College of Arts and Sciences. So that's 4 master's programs, and as well as 12 majors, I believe, and something like 11 minors. So the major in geology will be gone. The major in religion would be gone. Greek and Latin as well. The major in Italian, religion. So it's really a pretty impressively broad range of programs that are being targeted. And then some of these programs will be have courses still. Some of them will still have minors. But it is, you know, it is like a pretty broad range.
Now, administrators, you mentioned as well, the administrators mentioned the low enrollment numbers as an explanation for the cuts. Do we know how low those numbers are in some of these areas?
Yeah, so some of them are pretty low. So all of them have awarded under 7 degrees on average per year over the last couple years. Now, many of them have awarded more like 1 or 2 degrees per year over the last couple years. The average is probably around 3 or 4. So, you know, in terms of enrollment, you know, they're looking at the lowest enrollment programs in the college. That being said, I think something that a lot of faculty will say who are in these programs is that the enrollment figures are really not, you know, a sort of holistic measure of the impact of these programs. So some of the programs, even though they're sort of graduating just a couple students per year in their major, are enrolling many more just in courses, or they're offering concentrations in different majors. So, you know, I think the enrollment figures are low, but I think there is, when you talk to faculty about it, they'll bring up other things to consider here.
We've seen overall enrollment numbers at small colleges around Vermont and New England dropping recently. Do these enrollment numbers dropping in these specific areas reflect enrollment numbers overall at UVM being down, or is UVM's enrollment still staying afloat and robust?
You know, I cannot say exactly what UVM's enrollment numbers have looked like over the past few years, but definitely they are far lower. At least the College of Arts and Sciences is really the one school at UVM that is contending with this kind of low enrollment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that, and that is true sort of in the liberal arts in a broader sense nationally. You are seeing low enrollment in sort of the more traditional liberal arts majors and programs. You know, so this is an issue that schools around the country are really contending with and thinking about how to deal with.
Those majors aren't as sexy as they once were, aren't as sexy as things like maybe game design. So I definitely understand that. There's also been some contention, Katya, that the numbers are low because UVM is only accepting a low number of applicants in these programs. What have you found there?
Yes. So that is the key point. And, you know, that is not what the university says. They say that the issue is that, you know, they're accepting numbers of students and their yield, the number of students that accept into the school is pretty low. But what the faculty union has put out is an argument that, you know, at the end of the day, the university does control how many students it accepts into the College of Arts and Sciences. And so, you know, they presumably have the ability to raise that number pretty significantly if they would like. And they believe that, you know, they say that, you know, the number of students being accepted into the College of Arts and Sciences has declined, or that the university has accepted has declined by about 22% in recent years. So that they think that is contributing to the low enrollment in the first place.
Overall, this idea of cutting these 12 majors, 11 minors, and 4 grad programs, how has the faculty at the school reacted so far?
Yeah, pretty badly, I would say. I mean, not to speak for everyone, but from, you know, people I've spoken to about this. I mean, a big issue was the dean of the college, Bill Falls, announced all of this very long memo he released on December 2nd, but, you know, he did not consult with any faculty or students any time before releasing the memo. So, you know, people were really just absolutely blindsided by this. And so I think that faculty, like, from the outset felt just excluded from the process. Furthermore, you know, their jobs are on the line and their research, and, you know, I think that they are frustrated that this decision was made, you know, just from the top down. They weren't consulted, and that, you know, it was made based on looking just at these enrollment numbers, which many of them feel are not an accurate picture of the impact of their work.
I'm speaking with Katya Schwenk from VT Digger, and we're talking about the proposed cuts at UVM. Are faculty cuts part of this plan? Do we know that yet, Katya?
So we don't know that, and that is sort of the big question. It is, so, you know, I think that will be there. I've heard from faculty that there have been at least signs that could be coming, and, you know, the university is not contractually obligated to keep them on if they cut programs. They have to consider whether or not they could move faculty to somewhere else if their department is cut. And, you know, the other thing is that it is a little bit difficult to imagine the amount of savings that this would really yield if it doesn't also combine with you know, faculty layoffs. That is really the bulk of spending in the colleges on personnel. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's a huge fear of faculty and the feeling that they're being left in limbo because that hasn't been announced yet. And so for the next however many months as sort of these programs are finalized or not finalized, they're just sort of going to be stuck waiting to see what happens to their jobs.
What is the College of Arts and Sciences budget shortfall right now?
Right. So it is $8.6 million for the 2020 fiscal year. And then they're projecting that over the next 2 years, it'll be a combined, like, three-year deficit of about $27 million. And so for context, in fiscal year 2018, the deficit was $3 million. In 2017, it was $1.73 million. So we are seeing sort of every year an increase in budget. Oh, actually, 8.6 is for fiscal year 2021.
And by lopping off these majors and minors and grad programs, do they make up the 8.6 million or anything close to it?
Right. So that's the question, and I think that's not quite determined again because we don't know what will happen to faculty as of right now. And in an email that was sort of posted on social media, the dean was quoted as saying it would save $600,000 to $800,000 in administrative costs. And again, that's not an official figure that the university has officially released. But, you know, it's true that there will be some savings, you know, like administrative staff at programs or other sort of costs like that will be gone. But, you know, I think it is sort of hard to see without, you know, what exactly the savings will be. And, you know, when you're facing an $8.6 million deficit, you know, that does seem somewhat small.
Yeah, well, they got the 0.6 part of it wiped out, it looks like. Katya, we should note that the cuts that we're talking about are not a done deal. It's just a proposal. So what's the next step?
Right. So, yes, we are actually a pretty long way from knowing what is going to happen with these. So, you know, the next step, which is beginning to happen right now, is that the cuts will be reviewed by the Faculty Senate, which is sort of a body of faculty. And in the case of any contested program termination, the Faculty Senate needs to do a whole evaluation. They need to, you know, look at all these different measures of impact of programs and faculty. And so that's a pretty expensive process. And then they will give their recommendation on whether the program should be terminated for each program to the president and provost. You know, it's important to note that vote is not binding and doesn't have any authority really, so it's mostly an advisory call. And then it will move on to the Board of Trustees, and the Board of Trustees will give the final say. They have not really commented publicly on their thoughts on this, so we're a little in the dark on what that will even look like. You know, and I think that it is important to note that the Faculty Senate President, who I've spoken with, Thomas Chittenden, has said he is nervous that, you know, even though there is this review process, that because of the way this is sort of rolled out, the university is pretty intent on these program cuts being presented to the board, you know, as is. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is this worry that the process has been skipped a little bit and it might not be, you know, thought out as well as it could be for other suggestions.
What have you been hearing from students in these programs?
Right. So, I mean, you know, it was pretty impressive to watch in the day after this was announced how quickly there was just an uproar of petitions and people talking on social media and organizing and all of this. So, you know, I think I don't know if the university really intended or anticipated the kind of backlash they were going to get, and much of that was driven by students. And I think students, you know, I've heard many different things. I've heard some students who are about to graduate, you know, feeling really sad that they, you know, the next generation of kids at UVM are not going to have access to programs that were really meaningful to them. And then I've also heard from freshmen who are just coming in who say, you know, I feel kind of betrayed that I was given this picture of the classes I could take and the courses I was going to be able to enroll in. And, you know, now, you know, many of those majors and minors are just no longer going to exist by the time I'm graduating. So I think that there is this frustration from the student body that is really being heard right now.
Has the school promised that anyone enrolled in those programs will be able to continue until graduation in that major or minor?
Yeah, so that's important to note, is that anyone who is currently enrolled in the programs will be able to complete their major and minor, and likely it will be, you know, a significant amount of time before the programs are finalized. So, you know, even next semester, there are not going to be any changes as a result of this. So we're really looking at least to next year in terms of how this is going to affect the future of UVM.
The pushback that UVM is getting, is it just from faculty and students within these majors, or does it go wider and broader throughout the university?
I think it is wider and broader. I think that the people who have been most outspoken about this are the people, obviously, who are being directly affected. But, you know, I mean, I've seen people of all different sorts of majors talking about this. I mean, I think there are some that believe that this is sort of a tough but necessary call for the future of the university. But, I mean, if you look at, you know, the petitions and conversations around this, it really does feel like a whole community, you know, frustrated and hoping to change these announcements.
Are people worried that this could be the tip of the iceberg, more cuts to other programs that would possibly affect their major or minor?
Yeah, and they're sort of right to believe that. So the reason that the College in Arts and Sciences, and there are eight other schools at UVM, or schools and colleges, the College of Arts and Sciences was the first to release these program cuts, and that's because, so the provost has said, the college has sort of been thinking about how to you know, restructure for a long time. However, the provost has said that she has directed deans of all the other schools to take a hard look at their low enrollment numbers and really think about and recommend similar kinds of consolidation or restructuring and cuts. So those we're going to see at the beginning of next year. And, you know, I think that has also made people nervous. And again, there are no specifics on, you know, what that would look like. But, you know, that is something that is coming.
You mentioned Provost Patricia Prelock. There's also Dean Bill Falls. Both of them have been kind of out in front. Is it them together who's put this together? Or, you know, who's really who's behind this proposal in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to say. I think Bill Falls has been, for, you know, his sort of tenure as dean, pretty adamant about this kind of consolidation. But I would say he definitely has the whole support of the administration, you know, president in doing this. So, I mean, if you talk to faculty about it, many have described this to me as sort of an effort that has been happening for a long time, under the administration of Suresh Garamelli. So, I mean, I think that, yeah, I definitely wouldn't pin this to any one particular person. I think it's sort of a broad effort.
And has UVM President Suresh Garamelli made any announcement about the proposal for the proposed cuts?
I don't know, actually, if he has made a public comment about this. I would imagine, but again, I do think that, the whole administration has pretty much announced their support. I know Patricia Prelock has, and, you know, the dean. So, but yeah, I'm not sure, about Garamella in particular.
And Katia, what's the next key date that we'll hear something about, where this goes?
You know, that is the key question. It is unclear. the Faculty Senate is hoping, I think, to drag out this process. At least that is what I've heard from some faculty. And so they have, you know, estimating they can evaluate a couple of these programs per month. in terms of, you know, do their whole vote and recommendation about whether they're going to be cut. So it's not really clear when, how long this is going to take, when it's going to become before the Board of Trustees. The Board of Trustees meets, I believe, 3 times a year. So I think, if I could guess, I would say it would be, it's probably likely that these, at least something will be up for a vote by the time the board meets in May of the spring of 2021.
Katia Schwenk follows what's happening in Burlington for VT Digger. Thank you so much for joining the program today to let us know about what's happening at UVM.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
And that's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint, produced by Taylor Dobbs, directed by Lee Cattell. And I'm Rick Singeri. I will meet you back here tomorrow.